It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For this state budget cycle, campus leaders at the universities of Wisconsin asked for an $855 million funding increase. Governor Evers also called for a substantial boost in his budget proposal.
But Republican lawmakers in the state assembly have floated the idea of an $87 million budget cut to the UW system.
This comes as UW-Madison announced yesterday that campus units will need to cut their budgets by 5 to 7% amid the uncertainty of federal funding.
Terry McTaggart is former chancellor of UW-Superior and former head of the Minnesota State University System. He's co-author of the book The New College President, How a Generation of Diverse Leaders is Changing Higher Education. Terry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Rob. It's terrific to be here in a little Wisconsin accent.
As a former chancellor in the UW system at Superior and someone still paying attention to higher education, what are your thoughts on this budget gap here? The university asking for a big raise, the assembly, at least as a starting point, saying, no, how about an $87 million cut?
Well, you know, Wisconsin has always had a tough political environment on both sides. So this is just a kind of continuation in many ways of what I experienced before. But the issues are important. And while these may be starting points for both sides, the future of the state and the future of the university is critical to everybody in the state. So the issues are serious.
This is a unique time, given what's happening in the federal government. As we mentioned, UW-Madison saying, hey, everybody, we're cutting 5 to 7% from each department because of uncertainties about federal grants, a lot of money not coming in from the federal government. Is this a time that you'd want to see the state step up and make that whole?
Well, you can certainly make that argument, Rob. Higher education is in chaos right now. A lot of it stemming from Washington, frankly, but also from prior pressures, you know, demographic cliffs in states like Wisconsin and Minnesota, and just uncertainty in the economy generally. But yeah, if the feds are pulling away from what's most important to Wisconsin, research, economic development, solid education for the workforce of the future, then I don't see how the state can pile on. They need to step up.
We hear often from higher education advocates that campuses, UW campuses, play a big role in local communities, local economies. Your experience in Superior, how did you see that playing out?
Well, there's just a very, very tight connection between all of the universities. Certainly Madison is the flagship, but in greater Wisconsin, Oshkosh, River Falls, wherever it might be, the ties between the community, not just economically, but in terms of culture and in terms of thinking about the sustainability, particularly rural communities, universities are a major player, and hobbling them is not going to do Wisconsin any favors.
Now, we talked to Representative Dave Murphy yesterday, a Republican in the legislature. He said that $87 million cut is a starting point, not a done deal, but he did raise some concerns that he'd want to see addressed from the university. One thing, he expressed concern about a lack of transparency he saw with how money is being used across UW schools. He says when you start trying to dig into where the money's going, it's not always clear. Here's a little of what he had to say.
One of the concerns that we've had in the past with the university system is there's a lack of transparency sometimes about how things are done.
Do you think there is room for improvement, Terry, on how universities show what they're spending on, how they're using state resources, especially communicating that, say, to state lawmakers?
Well, Rob, you know, if an influential and intelligent lawmaker like Representative Murphy says we have a problem, you need to pay attention to it. Having said that, you know, both sides launch these kind of slogans, if you will, lack of transparency, and sometimes getting even more into the political side of DE&I and critical race theory and so on. I would prefer to focus on the facts. If a legislator, governor has a question, the university should pony up the response. And frankly, I'm sure they will. If anybody's got data, it's the university. Why would they try to hide it? But getting to the bottom of it and, you know, saying goodbye to kind of slogans and accusations on both sides, is something that's not going to get us or Wisconsin where it needs to be.
also concerns, as you mentioned, about things like DEI. Speaker Voss, as we're hearing in the news, raised concerns about political correctness. Representative Murphy, again, in that conversation yesterday, said, hey, there's not enough diversity viewpoints, and he's worried about critical thinking in certain fields. Here's a listen.
When it comes to the hard sciences, whether it be, you know, the chemistries or biologies and that sort of thing, you know, that's not so much of a problem. But when you get into the humanities, then, you know, I think it is a problem.
And that's not just Representative Murphy or Republican lawmakers. I think it's fair to say, Terry, there's a widespread, at least perception, that in some fields of humanities and maybe social sciences, there's a left-leaning point of view, conservative voices maybe not heard as well. What do you say to those concerns?
You know, I think this is a great opportunity, Rob, for the universities to level the playing field. You know, we pride ourselves on free debate and discussion and all of that going along with academic freedom. I think it's going to be important for the universities to bend over backward to make sure that opposing points of view are heard respectfully, and debated fully. And then the speaker and Representative Murphy and the like, maybe invite them on the campus to engage in those kinds of conversations. Nothing's to be lost when people of goodwill and civil behavior learn to disagree agreeably and respectively.
Terry McTaggart is with us, former chancellor of UW-Superior, co-author of the book The New College President. We are looking at higher education funding in the state budget that's in the works now. University asking for an increase. Assembly Republicans say, how about a cut? Terry, another concern that's been raised by some Republicans in the legislature is administration costs. So they say, hey, we're seeing more administrators. Money should be going to direct education. This is an argument that's had elsewhere in the country, I know, as well. Is there something there? Do we have a problem with too much, I don't know, middle management in universities?
You're right, Rob. That is a common complaint. And in some cases, it's justified, frankly. But by and large, any additional administrators have been in the area of student support and student services. So it's the students who are benefiting, even if it's not a faculty position. You know, if you look at the history of cuts from the time of Governor Thompson to the president against the university, there's been one heck of a lot of belt tightening. Right now, you know, two-year institutions are being merged and scheduled for shutting down. There have been cutbacks in a variety of other areas. I'm not saying that any, you know, state-supported enterprise like the university can't do better, but this University of Wisconsin, more than most in the country, I would say, have been to the well and reduced their resources and tried to do more with less and still perform as it is. I mean, it's a world-class institution, one of the glories of the state of Wisconsin. So this is not the time for the economic future of the state or for its kind of cultural future to be pulling away from the University of Wisconsin.
Terry, from your experiences at UW-Superior in Minnesota, writing the new college president, if a, say, chancellor of a UW system school came to you and said, Terry, there's a lot going on here. What should I do? What advice would you have for them?
But that's a great, great question, Rob. And of course, a lot of chancellors and campus presidents are asking that of themselves. I would say, man, the work is worth doing. The people of Wisconsin, and we know how great Madison is, but let me talk about the outstate campuses like Superior. That's where the vast middle range of the people of Wisconsin get the training and education they need to prosper in that community, to hire others, to have a better future for their kids and their grandkids. So my word would be, sure, it's tough. Well, it's tough for everybody these days. But the work of a chancellor or a president is really, really important, and I would encourage them to step up and take it on.
I've seen some efforts at public and private universities to rethink, like, okay, we're not just bringing in those students out of high school, doing a four-year degree, and that's it. Efforts to reach out more to older workers, to high school students and more. Do you see interesting ways that people are rethinking what a college, what a university is?
Well, that's absolutely true, Rob, and they ought to be doing it. These are political, economic, social, and educational centers for their community. We all have to think differently about the future, particularly now when it's so uncertain and just disrupted. So whether it's working with recent high school graduates, helping them get a good start in life, or a displaced worker, or someone maybe who's been injured and can't do what they used to do for a living, helping them to adjust to the new economic realities. That's a kind of a multi-service enterprise these days, much more so than in the legacy past where we just deal with 18 and 19-year-olds.
And one thing that people who are maybe sending a kid to college or who are going to college themselves might be wondering about, what does all this mean for tuition? What would you say to state lawmakers and university leaders when it comes to what that price tag is going to be?
Well, the price tag is important. And as your listeners should know, if they don't already, it's the net price after financial aid that you should be looking at, not just the sticker price, to use that term. But, you know, you mentioned kids, and I would add grad kids to it. Mm-hmm. The average age of a Wisconsin legislator, state legislator, is around 50 years old. So many of them have kids and grandkids. And I would hope that as this debate goes forward, they think about what kind of life those kids are going to have 10, 15, 20, 30 years from now. I did a little research. You know, I've worked and loved both Wisconsin and Minnesota. But the per capita income in Wisconsin compared to Minnesota has slipped in the last 40 years. Right now, it's about a $7,500 gap in per person income compared in Wisconsin compared to Minnesota. That's a lot of dough, and particularly when you magnify it over year in and year out. What's the difference? Minnesota has supported its educational infrastructure, its university systems, et cetera, to a greater degree.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Terry McTaggart, former chancellor of UW-Superior, co-author of the book The New College President. Been talking about what's at stake if the state legislature followed through with a proposed $87 million cut to the UW budget. For disclosure, WPR is a service of UW-Madison.
Coming up, high temperatures can be a big risk at the workplace. A Wisconsin public health expert says we need to take it seriously.
The scary thing about heat is that even healthy young people can be very severely impacted.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Here's a follow-up to a conversation we had a couple of months back looking at our personal data and privacy and the DOGE effort at the federal government.
I talked then to Chad Johnson, assistant professor and principal faculty member for cybersecurity programs at UW-Stevens Point. He's director of the Digital Forensics Lab there. There have been a lot of new developments since we had that conversation, including a court ruling giving DOGE more access to Social Security data and a private company contract to merge lots of government information. Chad Johnson told me he was already worried about the handling of our personal data. These latest developments have him even more concerned.
The consolidation and aggregation of that data presents an even larger risk for potential abuse within the United States. And it seems like Palantir, a company that was founded in the early 2000s, just after 9/11 and the Patriot Act and everything, is now positioned to take advantage of the data that's been consolidated into a system of potential surveillance on the U.S. public.
Can you talk about the kinds of data, if all these different sources within the federal government are merged together, how much could be cross-referenced and known about people for the purposes of surveillance?
Well, I mean, it is everything. Up until this point, all of the information from the various different government bureaucracies have more or less been in a silo, and that was by design. They didn't want to put all of their eggs in one basket or give any one department too much insight into the workings of another as a way of sort of diversifying away the risk that consolidating that data might represent. But we are at a point now where it seems as if we're bumping into those Chesterton fences and no longer recall exactly why they were siloed to begin with. But consider that, for example, the U.S. Census Bureau contains relatively benign information, directory information, your name, your address, and a few other little bits of information. But if we were to consolidate that with perhaps information that has been gathered for scientific purposes from various GPS satellites, along with the IRS, along with immigration, along with, you know, whatever other system that you like, the more data you consolidate, the more you're able to contribute to the process known as disambiguation. And what that means is that if you have a large data set, you can process it to essentially find the details of one individual to the exclusion of all other individuals within that population. Meaning, essentially, you can discover just about anything about a person's life, their comings, their goings, where they work, the amount they donate to charity, their immigration status, whether or not they've gotten fines recently. It really doesn't end.
If a government, an administration, was willing to use the mechanisms of government to target individual people for advanced surveillance or worse, what do you see as the potential impact of this, the potential damage?
Sure. Well, to be clear, as I mentioned, Palantir has been around since the early 2000s. They are part of what allowed the U.S. to conduct the war on terror in the fashion that it did, because they were doing this already. They developed systems that would help the U.S. military and other agencies to narrow down sources, to disambiguate to a single individual and find their location. And there have been many allegations about this being used already or misused already. So we don't have to guess what the possibilities are here. What we're looking at now is an unprecedented expansion in the capabilities of those programs to include not just the data streams that we previously had from the U.S. intelligence community, possibly the armed forces, or maybe a couple of other direct sources, but now from every system in the U.S. government.
The worries about misuse by the government may seem obvious. Is there anything that says, hey, Palantir or other companies involved with people, with staff in the DOGE system couldn't also access this vast amount of data for whatever they would want to do with it?
Yeah, exactly. That's part of the problem that we have here. We already have former members of Palantir, the company, that have left, that have gotten together to protest the way that the Palantir systems are being used by immigration forces now. But yes, we have also had previous instances recently where there have been targeted harassment against certain ethnic or religious groups. And I was asked at the time by some of those individuals how this was even possible. Well, this is exactly how it's possible. It's easy with enough information to disambiguate that population and target only people of certain ethnicities or certain genders or people who take certain medication even. And just imagine the power that presents to anyone that could make use of that information for really any purpose. I mean, the idea is that Palantir and the U.S. government are going to use it for national security purposes and to make our nation safer. But it could be leveraged by anyone for any reason. Technology is amoral, and this is just technology. It's entirely in how it's wielded. And right now, we're basically just trusting them to use it correctly.
If a member of Congress came to you, Chad, and said, hey, I'm worried about this, what guardrails should we try to put into law to protect the privacy and security of American citizens? Where would you say they should start?
Well, there's a lot of ways we could improve on the situation because we're basically starting from zero. But from a governance perspective, we absolutely need to have regulations in place here and to establish an explicit right to privacy in the United States, similar to what they did with GDPR in the EU. We cannot simply go on without it. It's already gone on too long already.
Chad, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's Chad Johnson, Assistant Professor of Computing and New Media Technologies, Director of the Digital Forensics Lab, and Principal Faculty Member of the Undergraduate and Graduate Cybersecurity Programs at UW-Stevens Point. He joined us for a follow-up to a conversation we had about DOGE and personal data from a couple months back. Wisconsin is entering the summer months with a continent-spanning heat wave with temperatures reaching over 90 degrees in many parts of the state.
That can be a serious health concern in a lot of workplaces, but there aren't many regulations related to heat safety on the job.
Catherine McCoy directs the State Department of Health Services Occupational Health and Safety Surveillance Program. She co-wrote a report last year on heat risk in the workplace. Kate, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
A report you co-authored last year says heat stress on the job could be a bigger problem as climate change starts to make days hotter. What kind of things are we worried about?
Yeah, thank you. Well, hotter temperatures are a severe and persistent health risk for anybody who is exposed to those higher temperatures, but especially for people who have to work in that kind of heat stress. And so what we worry about under those conditions are both the risks that workers face of, frankly, of death on the job in the worst circumstances, or also of being sickened to the point where they have to walk off the job, and the cumulative effects that heat can have on the body if people are exposed day after day.
In that report I mentioned, you looked at what kind of fields of work, what kind of occupations were reporting problems with heat and filing disability claims, things like that. What are some of the fields you really have your eye on here?
Yeah, thank you. So if you think about who you would expect to be at risk when we're facing extreme heat, it's a lot of the kinds of jobs and industries that you would expect to see. So a lot of folks who spend all or part of their day working outside, whether that's construction, landscaping, folks who are doing delivery driving, truck drivers coming in and out of their vehicle, et cetera, trash collection, utility workers, lots and lots of people who are engaged in outdoor work. But then there are also some indoor workers who are in poorly ventilated and poorly cooled environments, or environments where there's heat being generated inside. So you think about the folks who are working in kitchens, in some manufacturing and production facilities, in some warehouses. And that's really, those are really the types of jobs that we see as most at risk. Not covered in our report, but also very much at risk are agricultural workers. Who didn't rise to the top in our report because we're looking at workers' compensation claims, and a lot of them aren't going to be reflected in that. But farm workers are also a group that's at very high risk, as well as law enforcement and firefighters.
What is your message to employers, especially in those fields you just mentioned, of how to create a safe workspace, outdoor workspace, as the case might be, when it's hot?
Yes, thank you. So the message to employers right now is, first of all, awareness. Make sure that you're aware that heat is a serious risk for your workers. And it doesn't have to be an extreme heat wave for people to be severely affected, especially if people are working long hours in the heat, if they are doing a lot of physical exertion, if they have any underlying health conditions or are pregnant or are taking medications that dehydrate them. There are a lot of different reasons why people can be at risk of extreme heat-related illness outcomes. And so for employers to be aware and to get themselves trained, get their workers trained on what to do, how to recognize the signs and symptoms of heat exhaustion and heat stroke, and to know what to do in those cases, to know first aid, to know when to call, and to have a plan for how to address those situations and how to prevent them. The other thing that employers can do is think about cooling their environment as much as possible. If you're talking about an indoor environment, make sure you have good ventilation, good AC, things like that, and adjusting your work practices. So we really need for workers to have access to water, rest, and shade. And so if those things aren't readily available and workers don't know that they can take advantage of them, make sure that you implement those on your work site. You might need to modify your schedules to make sure that people aren't working during the hottest time of the day. You might need to slow down some of the work in order to make sure that people are staying safe and healthy, and that they are actually able to be more productive, because all of us get less productive as the temperature goes up. So those frequent breaks are helpful, not just for health and safety, but also for productivity.
We're talking to Kate McCoy with the Department of Health Services Occupational Health and Safety Surveillance Program, talking about heat at the workplace, the health hazards of heat, and how to prevent harm from those hot days on the job. Kate, we don't need to dig deep into medical symptoms and things like that, but are there common things you say to employers and, I guess, coworkers to watch for that says, hey, this employee or this colleague might be showing the early signs of trouble with heat?
Absolutely. So look for things like starting to feel anything where you're starting to feel unwell. For worker, pay attention to it in the heat. So in particular, pay attention to things like dizziness, nausea, vomiting. If somebody starts to lose consciousness or is in an altered state, all of a sudden they're not making sense. Maybe it seems like they're drunk, something like that. They're confused. That's a very serious warning sign. If people start seizing, very serious warning sign. So those are warning signs of potential heat stroke. That's an immediate 911 call.
Now, the idea of taking heat seriously, I don't think it's always out there. I remember when I was younger and at a job with some of the characteristics you mentioned, right, out in the heat, and we were all young, dumb, tough guys who, you know, weren't going to worry about heat bothering us. Send the message to people that, yes, heat is a serious potential health concern.
Absolutely. And what you're describing is so common, and we know that. And all of us tend to think that we're immortal, right? You know, that's a very human tendency. The scary thing about heat is that even healthy young people can be very severely impacted. And there are cases in the US of young, healthy people dying on the job due to heat. And one of the most important things I think to know that people don't necessarily know is that those early days on a job when your body is not acclimatized to heat are the most dangerous. So up to 70% of heat-related deaths on the job occur in the first week on the job. So my mind goes to seasonal employees, to teen workers who are doing a summer job, and maybe that teen worker is a student athlete, but they're not used to working outside 8 to 10 hours a day, unprotected, with that kind of sustained physical exertion. And their body, even if they're physically fit, isn't equipped right out of the gate to start doing that kind of work. So those are some of the really important things that we want to avoid. We want to have a summer without any deaths on the job due to heat.
When it comes to workplace regulations, we have our eye on the federal level. There were some guidelines coming in toward the end of the Biden administration. A lot of the people involved in those guidelines have been removed from their posts under the Trump administration, so maybe nothing coming from there soon. Do we have, in Wisconsin, state standards when it comes to heat in the workplace?
Yeah, this is a really important point. We do not have any protections at this point that would say that workers are required to have water, rest, and shade, for instance, on the job. So you can be made to work in extreme temperatures at this point. Luckily, there is still a process going on at the federal level, which would cover Wisconsin, of enacting some really long overdue and important heat protections to make sure that people do have those kind of basic protections on the job and make sure that people have access to water, that people have basic training in heat illness prevention. Right now, this week and next week, there are public hearings on that federal standard. We're hopeful that it will continue to move forward. It's a good sign that it is continuing to move forward at this point. But more action is needed.
And briefly, Kate, can you send a message to employers to take heat seriously, even while they're waiting to see what happens with these regulations?
Absolutely. So these regulations, if they go forward, take a long time. And as we just discussed, heat-related deaths and severe injuries can happen in the blink of an eye. And no employer wants to be the one who loses someone on the job. So there's lots of things that employers can do right now. There are lots of great tools that you can implement right away. One thing I would recommend for both employers and workers is just to download the OSHA NIOSH heat safety tool. It's a great app that you can look at every day. You can figure out, you know, what is the heat risk? And then you can see also what are the signs and symptoms of heat-related illness that you need to look out for and what to do in that case. And it also talks to employers about, you know, what are some of the protections you can put in place so that you're not losing workers and you're not losing productivity or facing things like equipment damage from workers who are foggy-headed and making more mistakes.
Kate, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Catherine McCoy is Program Supervisor for the State Department of Health Services Occupational Health and Safety Surveillance Program. We've been talking about heat and worker safety. Hey, has your workplace made changes to account for those hot summer days? Let us know what kind of precautions you are seeing, or maybe ones you wish you saw at your workplace. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Again, that email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a prolific playwright from Wisconsin has written over 150 plays for teenagers and sees the value in stage productions.
I think it's great for young people to take a break from electronics and just be, you know, performing.
A conversation with a creative force behind high school theater, that's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The most produced playwright in American schools has roots in Wisconsin. Don Zelaitis has written over 150 plays for young people.
Zelaitis grew up in Janesville, and that's where his inspiration for writing started, making fun of what he saw in the classroom.
I would make fun of things that were happening in my school, and that was the creative outlet for me. My friends always enjoyed, like, reading these rather satirical stories that I would write about my middle school teachers. So I apologize to my middle school teachers out there.
Chances are, apology accepted. As a former grade school teacher, Zelaitis knows what gets students excited to perform.
His new one-act play is called The Price, and he joins us to talk about his body of work. Don, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you take into consideration when writing a play for youth versus writing a play for adults?
Well, it's almost the same process. I really try to utilize all of my skill, all of my talent, everything that I would write in a play for adults, I put it in a play for young people. I don't try and limit myself for, you know, vocabulary or complexity. I'm really just trying to tell a story that might appeal to younger people, but doesn't insult their intelligence, isn't cheesy, doesn't speak down to them.
How do you approach topics that are difficult in your plays, like, for instance, social media or cyberbullying or mental health with young people?
The thing I think about the most is trying to be truthful and honest. Young people know if you're not telling the truth. And I think telling the truth is often complicated, and it's often not simple. So I think when I'm dealing with a difficult subject matter, I am just trying to be honest, be truthful, and really deal with multiple sides of things. I think where sometimes plays for young people get this reputation of being, I don't know, simple or child stuff is when they try to simplify something that is actually much more complex.
And would you write in different characters who have different perspectives, or how would you go about that in your cast development?
Well, that's a great thing that theater does probably better than any other art form, is that it's able to show multiple sides of the same subject. So often, if there is a like a difficult conundrum in a play, you can put people on both sides of that argument. And ideally, both of those sides are correct, and both of those sides are believed in by the people who are arguing them. So a play really isn't something that provides answers. A play is something that questions a subject. So in that sense, when you have multiple perspectives, you're really able to get into the different facets of an argument. So for instance, you know, one of the plays that I wrote is about the Badger Munitions Factory in Wisconsin. I set it during World War II, and there's a moment in the play where the women ordnance workers who are there at the plant are realizing that they're not being paid the same amount of money as the men. So there's a movement among some of them to strike for better wages or fair wages or equal wages to the men. Whereas on the other side, there's other people who are arguing that going on strike in a munitions factory during a war will harm people that they care and love about. So the play doesn't really take a side in that argument. The play presents the argument, and the people who are arguing are passionate and they believe in what they're arguing for, and they make very good points. But that's a thing that's left to the audience to discover and to think about what they really think about that issue.
And the Badger Army Ammunition Plant, this is that large munitions factory during World War II in Freedom, Wisconsin. And so you're taking this piece of history and turning it into a play. And as you mentioned there, you know, history is sensitive. It can be interpreted through so many different lenses. So how do you work with that when it's, you know, taking a stage production here, but also mm-hmm. having to hold a piece of real history in it as the center?
I think you have to, as a playwright, you have to have an empathetic imagination, which means you have to imagine what it's like to be somebody else and to have a different perspective. I started out as an actor, and one of the great things about being a playwright is essentially you get to act all the parts in the show when you're writing it. So I'm trying to imagine circumstances of being different kinds of people when I'm writing a play like Badger. People who lived in a different time, people of different age, different gender. And in order to access, you know, what I'm going to call truth, I have to really try to be honest and imagine those circumstances. And I think if you do that well, the characters are going to seem fleshed out and real and three-dimensional and interesting to play. And of course, once a performer gets in that role, whether it's a teenager or an adult or whether they're in Wisconsin or somewhere else, they're going to bring their own perspective to that part and they're going to imbue it with something from themselves, and it's going to be a different kind of performance than anything else.
Don Zelaitis is with us, one of the most prolific playwrights in American schools, has written more than 150 plays. How do you stay disciplined and just keep your creative juices flowing?
Well, I tell this to kids all the time, that people think that creativity is a talent. It's something that you're born with. But I think that creativity is a skill, which means that's something that you can get better at the more you do it. So for instance, I'm constantly coming up with ideas for new shows, and that's kind of how I spend my day. And since I've done so much of it, I'm actually quite good at coming up with ideas at this point in time. So because I've exercised that muscle so much, I always feel like there's more ideas to come.
You sometimes work with high schools on the production of your plays. What do you learn from those experiences?
Oh, those are fantastic. I love being in rehearsal with groups that are doing a new show. Probably they're premiering a play. And it's great to be able to first exercise that part of myself that was a director and teacher and be able to work with people directly again. And also you learn a lot about the play itself in rehearsal, parts that are weaker, parts that are stronger. And when you have 20 teenagers in a show and you're trying to get the language to sound like teenagers, they're a very good gauge of whether or not you're just a middle-aged old man trying to sound young or whether it sounds authentic to them or not. So sometimes that's very helpful.
Does it help you to see your play staged to know, like what you said, what's working in the script, what might need tweaking? My thought is, like, you would have that tendency to be like, ooh, why did I write it that way?
Yeah, I think, you know, what really happens is things get cut. That's probably what happens the most in rehearsal, is that you realize you've said things three times and you don't only need to say it once, mm-hmm. or that the audience is following you and you don't need to belabor the point anymore. So you're usually shrinking the show mm-hmm. while you're doing it, which sometimes causes consternation because kids are very possessive of the number of lines they have in a play. Like, I have 27 lines. And then you're cutting three of them. And they're like, no. So you have to be a little gentle with it and be like, we're just trying to improve the play and, you know, hone it down. And I'm sorry that I'm cutting this one line that you were very attached to.
You were very passionate about. I noticed you convert a lot of your plays to one acts. What is the power of a one act play?
So one acts are usually how I started writing plays for young people. And what it was is I would be teaching middle school and I would want to rehearse a play during class time and then ultimately perform it during a class period. So I would have essentially 40 minutes, which gave people about like 7 minutes to get to the auditorium and 7 minutes to leave. So that would be a time frame that I'd be working in. And I think a lot of teachers out there do the same thing that I did, which is try and rehearse a play during a theater class, for instance. There's also things, this happens in Wisconsin too, there are one-act play competitions. So there are festivals where a bunch of schools will go and they will all perform a one-act play, like 30 to 40-minute play. And then they're judged by a judge or judges. And then there's a competition aspect to it. So a lot of professional playwrights don't write for that length of time. So there's not a lot of material out there for schools that want to do this.
Can you peel back the curtain, if you will, on how it works with the licensing of your plays? And whether you feel adequately compensated as the writer, and at the same time, is the work accessible for school theater programs and what's affordable for them?
In general, most of my plays are published by publishers, and those are also holding the rights. So when a school wants to do a show, they apply to the publisher for the right to perform it. And a school will pay a royalty for each performance that they want to do. Now, for a one-act play, that might be $50 or $60 a performance. So it's not a lot of money. And then I get a portion of that. So I'm published with six different publishing companies at this point. So schools can find the plays online. They get catalogs. And then they also get emails from me every once in a while telling them about new shows. And I think that if you're charging $5 a ticket to come see the play, for instance, it's pretty easy to make your money back on a one-act play or even a full-length play. They're not that expensive to do. It's not like a big musical that might cost a school $10,000 to get the rights for or something like that.
Wow, that's quite a difference. Is there a lot of difference between the costs of these licensing fees for these scripts?
There are. I mean, there are. If you're trying to do the biggest, hottest Broadway show that just came on the market.
Like Frozen, you know, it was a few years ago, right?
If Frozen, Hadestown, Harry Potter, things like that, they're pretty pricey for schools. It's not that they can't make their money back from them, but it's a bigger investment. But if you're a teacher and you want to do a play in your classroom, and you want to do it with your kids that you're teaching, you might not have a large budget to go out and buy Frozen. You might need to do something a little less expensive.
Can we talk about your most recent work, The Price? And this is about death. What would you like students to learn from it? And can you talk a little bit about the plot?
So it's a beautiful story. It's based on a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, The Story of a Mother. If I go into the story too much, I'm going to cry. So it's probably the most beautiful fairy tale I've ever read. It's a story about a mother whose small child is sick and is taken by death one night. And the mother essentially hunts down death and chases after him to get her child back. And in the process of doing so, she has to give up everything. She gives up, she actually trades her eyes away in order to get across a lake. She gives up her youth. She gives up her songs in order to hunt down death to get her child back. Hans Christian Andersen has some very melancholy stories. And there's a very beautiful moment in it where the mother finally makes her way to this greenhouse where there's a flower for every life in the world. And death is about to cut or pull up the flower that's her child's. And the mother, she grabs a random other flower and threatens to pull that one up instead. And death shows her what that life is that she was going to pull up. And it's this amazing, beautiful life of this person who lives 80 years. And there's this question that she asks, which is, why does one child get so little life and one child get so much? And I think, you know, that is a devastating thought. And it's a thought that, you know, if you're an adult in the audience, if you're a child in the audience, if you're elderly person in the audience, you can think that same thing, right? And the play doesn't give you an answer to that question, but it poses it. And I think that's the beauty of these amazing fairy tales, that you can have these incredibly deep, beautiful, powerful stories that are ostensibly aimed towards children, but they're really for all of us.
Do you find that your young actors have the ability to feel such profound sadness and feel that on stage and be able to really get to the heart of the drama?
I think they do. And I think that's part of not underestimating young people, because they're able to think and feel just as much as an adult.
Don, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to be here today.
That is Wisconsin native Don Zelaitis, considered the most prolific playwright for young people. You can see productions of some of his plays next school year at Elkhorn Area High School, Wisconsin Rapids Community Theater, and other stages.
Our budget year at WPR is coming to a close on June 30th. It's a time to make sure we end the year successfully and start the next one as strong as possible.
WPR has served Wisconsin for more than 100 years, thanks to the commitment of listeners. Your gift now really helps, and to encourage it, we have an early bird challenge.
When 1,200 people donate before our fund drive on Thursday, a generous group of members will give an additional $12,000.
Be counted now at WPR.org/donate. Once again, that's WPR.org/donate to make high-quality programming available to all. And thank you so much for your support.
Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson, Royce Padeswa, and Mackenzie Crummy. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.